Last week, as we continued the series of Nehemiah, the theme was about team building, bringing people together for the common sense to rebuild something together. And at the end of the first three services, Pastor Melissa, you know, she gave the benediction, and she was talking about how, you know, there are many gates that existed for this large wall, both in the past when it was first constructed, and then, of course, as they were rebuilding it, they had to build all these gates again. And I know you might not be able to see what all of them are called, but, you know, there's like the fish gate and the old gate and the east gate and the horse and the water and the valley. But there was one particular that the Melissa decided to wait until the very end to talk about, and that was the dung gate, which is for exactly what it sounds like. Now, thankfully, it wasn't like these gates were being used while they were being built, at least I hope so, but just the idea that someone had to be assigned to be in charge of that, you know, to rebuild it, to bring it back, that was probably not the most exciting thing to hear. But of course, Melissa's whole point was, even though it may not be the most glamorous, that does not mean that it is any less important than any others. The point is, there are too many times when people have thought that what they have to offer is not really all that great, that it's not that useful, that it is not worth anything. Now, maybe these thoughts come from our own uncertainty, or maybe we have not seen the opportunities in which we are able to share our gifts with others or with the world. Maybe we've just been told that we don't really have anything to offer because of who we are, that who we are is not worth anything. Nehemiah's whole vision and calling is about rebuilding a wall, about rebuilding a city, rebuilding a people. But of course, not all walls are good. Not all walls are helpful, and sometimes rather than building up, they can actually tear down. Or we end up building walls of things which separate us or make us feel isolated, that cut us off from the love and the encouragement that we so desperately need. So, how do we bring down walls of doubt and rejection, and how do we build up walls of encouragement? Now, I know you probably can't see what I wrote on that chalkboard during the song, but I do encourage you during communion, if you want to go up and to see those words and those phrases. And maybe it makes more sense that we can't see them from afar. Maybe we have to get more close and personal. Maybe that's when those words of negativity and discouragement really get to us. And maybe, like it, they come from shadows. Maybe they're not as loud, but yet they still deeply, deeply affect us. In fact, I was seeing that after I was done, you know, I had chalk dust all over me. I had chalk dust on my shoes, and I was brushing it off because that's our impulse, right? When we feel dirty, we have to get rid of it. We have to brush it away so that we look presentable in front of each other. How often do we allow these words to tell us who we are? I don't know if anyone who is invulnerable to self-doubt every day, all the time, 24/7. Nehemiah writes in this chapter 4 that we are looking at about the Samaritans, about the Ammonites, about the Ashdodites. He writes them as their enemies, their dream killers. Now, the Jewish readers probably know exactly who Nehemiah was writing about and probably had the same feelings as he did about them. These were neighboring tribes from the north and the south, from the east and the west, communities who did not trust each other. And so when Nehemiah and his co-workers are in the midst of clearing this debris and putting some of these stones back and building new ones, there are all of these folks, these different tribes and communities who are watching. And they're saying things like what Nehemiah writes about them. What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore things? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish it in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish? And burned ones at that. And then one of them, Tobiah the Ammonite, said, "That stone wall they are building, well, any fox who will jump on that could break it down." That may not sound very damaging, but to me, it kind of reminded me of that English heckler in the Geico commercial. You know, it kind of depends on the time and the context. The fox thing may not sound like a big deal, but of course, it was a different time. But, you know, the truth is, nobody likes to be heckled, certainly not in public. Now, imagine being in the midst of trying to piece together this old life, this new life, which, of course, is painful enough. Did you notice what one of them said about the burned stones? They are literally picking up these stones that one scholar says, you know, probably had soot and ash and burn marks from when the Babylonians invaded and destroyed their city and their temple. They're literally picking up those stones of rubbish and seeing the marks of destruction that this empire had placed upon them. How do we rebuild? How can we rebuild when the marks of destruction are staring right at us? And then Nehemiah, he kind of goes into this classical psalm, and it is one that we would probably read ourselves as we flip through the Psalms. He writes, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them over as a plunder in a land of captivity." He writes to God, "Do not cover their guilt and do not let their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have hurled insults in the face of the builders." And as I read that over and over again, I started wondering, you know, is Nehemiah, is he maybe looking to vengeance as a way to avoid? It can be easy to paint our enemies and our opposers as villains. And thus we pour out all of our negative emotions upon them, upon someone, something else. Now, sometimes it is necessary for us to confront our enemies. Sometimes it is necessary for us to be divisive, especially against oppression. But other times it can seem like it is easier for us to deal with others on the outside than it is for us to deal with ourselves on the inside. In the midst of these taunts, the Jewish people start to say, "The strength of the burden bearers is failing. There's too much rubbish so that we are unable to work on the wall." And our enemies are saying to us, "They will not know or see anything before we come upon them and kill them and stop the work." Nehemiah continues to write, "When the Jews who lived near them came, they said to us 10 times from all the places where they live, they will come up against us." We know these kinds of people, those who take our passion and our hopes and our dreams, and they just stamp on them. We kind of talked about this a couple of weeks ago when we began this series on Nehemiah, when Nehemiah has this dream and this vision, and he goes to his king, and he pleads his case. He says, this is my dream. This is my vision. This is my hope. This is what I want to do. And the king asks him, "Well, you know, how long will you be gone? When will you come back?" And so we talked about how, you know, there are those times when people ask us those practical questions about our idea, and we sort of feel deflated because they're kind of bringing us back into reality. And it can feel like they're killing our dream, when really what's happening is they're asking us questions that we probably should have asked ourselves already. But, you know, in those moments of excitement and passion, you know, details really aren't what we are trying to think about. We often don't want to think about the practicalities of how we make our dream possible. We just get all energized and positive, and we just want to do it. We just want to see it happen. And we might feel annoyed, and we might even feel crushed when we talk about with someone and they start asking us these realistic questions. And really, it's not that they're trying to destroy our dream. They're just trying to help us. And in fact, it is helpful. In fact, we need those people in our lives. We need teachers and coaches, someone to help us work out the details. Because it is a discipline. It is a discipline to turn a dream into a reality. It takes work. It takes commitment. Sometimes it even takes losing some of that impractical enthusiasm to bring us back to reality so we can actually get some of the work done, while at the same time not losing too much so that we just get burned out or we lose our passion and we just give up. That is incredibly hard to do, and it is why, unfortunately, so many dreams never come to life. It's why it is so important that we have those friends, that we have those teachers and those mentors to bridge that gap, to help us see the reality alongside our dream, but to also to continue to encourage us that we might make it possible. Now, there is a big difference between all of that and those who just want to see us fail. Sometimes it can be masked under the disguise of common sense, under the disguise of trying to help us, asking those questions of practicality, which really just squelches our passion and makes us doubt ourselves. And sometimes it is just outright telling us that we can't do it, that it won't work, that it will fail, that we are failures. We also have to ask ourselves, when have we crushed the dreams of someone else? You know, no one thinks of themselves as an evil person. No one thinks of themselves as, you know, waking up every morning and saying, you know, today I'm going to be a villain. Except maybe Skeletor. But that's the thing, isn't it? You know, as children, as kids, we are taught in very simplistic ways, you know, these people are good, these people are bad, these are heroes, and these are villains. And that's fine. The problem is when we take that simplistic viewpoint into our adulthood, that as, you know, the world and life and everything else becomes complicated, we stick on these simplistic views of what is good and what is bad, and that we can never be the villain of our own story. Sometimes it's not that simple. We do know there have been times when we have made bad choices. We do know there are times when we have said things we should not have, when we have participated in the crushing of someone else's dream. This last week at annual conference, I attended events which lifted up the realities of sexism and racism in the church, reminding us again that a place and a community which is to embody sanctuary has often allowed itself to be corrupted by the harmful words and actions against women and against people of color. One of the events had people read off comments that female clergy in this very conference had heard from other parishioners, other pastors, chair people of staff relations committees, in fact, even district superintendents. One female clergy stood in the pulpit of our historic sanctuary and told how she had experienced these in her own life and said that the Me Too movement is happening in the world, but it also needs to be happening in our church. Because if the church is not speaking into and against these words that are hurting so many people, then what is the point of being here? And perhaps the most powerful enemy, the most powerful killer of our dreams is ourselves. Many of us have heard about the deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, two celebrities who looked like they had it all, except they didn't. And we know that these are not isolated events. We definitely know that it didn't happen just because they were famous. Stories happen every single day and are often ignored of people who are in the very same circumstances, even if they're not celebrities, who are going through depression and pain and feelings of isolation so strong that they don't think that there is any way out except to end it. When we let these words and these phrases enter into our lives, into our minds and our hearts, we allow them to be true. We allow them to paint a picture of reality around us, and we begin to believe them, and we begin to even tell them to ourselves. But there is a difference, listen to me, there is a difference between failing and being a failure. Failing is inevitable. Failing is something that simply happens after time. It is a natural occurrence. Failing is a natural occurrence. It happens. It happens because we do things. It happens because we try things, often things that have not been tried before. But here's what failing is not. Failing is not a bad thing, and it is not a sign of weakness. We are slowly getting better in our society and in the United Methodist Church about lifting up failure, reminding each other that failure is something that happens when we try something, that failure is not a measure of weakness. It is, in fact, a measure of strength. It is a measure of learning. It is a measure of wisdom. Like Ms. Frizzle says, take chances, make mistakes, get messy. I think if we actually live by that philosophy, how many dreams would we be able to make possible? Failing only becomes negative when we let it define our outlook on life, when we let it crush our spirit, when we see it as a finality and not an opportunity. And see, here's the thing. We've all heard that before. We've read books about it, probably. We've seen celebrities and public speakers, motivational speakers, to say all this, but it is so hard to live out. I mean, failing just sucks, especially when we fail at our dreams, when we set ourselves to do something that we have seen in our minds and in our hearts, and it looks so clear and bright, and we put in all of this time and effort and work and sacrifice into making it happen, when we tell so many people about it with such courage and enthusiasm, and we put ourselves out there, maybe at the most vulnerable we have ever presented ourselves, and it gets rejected, or it gets ignored, or we're told that we can't do it, and it fails, and it scars. And for many of us, the instinct is not to go out and to try again. The instinct is to curl up, to hide away, to isolate ourselves, because we can't risk getting hurt again. You know who understands this more than anyone else in the world? Jesus. Because by our counts, especially by our society today, Jesus was a massive failure. I mean, Jesus had very little quantifiable, steady success. One day he would have thousands of followers. The next day he would have maybe 12. By the end, he had none. And oh yeah, he was killed. One of the most powerful stories for me in the Gospels comes from John 6. And this is the feeding of the 5,000 story. But really, it's after that. So all of these people that Jesus and his disciples have fed, they come back the next day expecting that bread again. And this is when Jesus sees the time, the opportunity to share with them his dream, his true dream of who he is and why he is here. He says, I am the bread. It's in me. And he does the thing that we have all done sometimes. He puts himself out there. He just pours out the personal vision and dream that he has, his whole identity, everything that he is. He says, this is me. And they all walk away. You say, what is this guy talking about? He's nuts. He's a crackpot. He doesn't have anything. And they all just leave. I mean, can you imagine thousands of people? I mean, Jesus has just poured himself out to thousands of people. And they just turn around and walk away. And I can imagine he just kind of stands there for a moment, you know, just frozen. And he turns around to his disciples, you know, the 12, and he says to them, well, what about you? Are you guys going to leave me too? I think it is one, if not the most human instance that we have of Jesus Christ in the Gospels. Because Jesus knows exactly what failure and rejection feel like. Realistically, practically, Jesus did not succeed. I mean, if Jesus was a pastor today, his vital stat dashboard would look terrible. But as someone once said, when was following Jesus ever practical? So kind of going back to the story of Nehemiah and talking about the Samaritans, for example, we start to understand why the Samaritans and the Jews don't like each other, why there is such hostility, why they oppose each other so much. And why Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan is so important for us to know and to understand. So remember, Jesus' people are Jewish. They are the descendants of Nehemiah and all of these rebuilders, those who had to endure the taunts of people like the Samaritans. And he tells them a story about the Samaritan being the hero. A Samaritan, people who they instantly had these feelings of animosity. Jesus is saying, this is the hero. The Samaritan who thought that a Jewish person was worth saving. And so where many saw division, Jesus saw connection. Where many saw failure, Jesus saw redemption. Where others saw destruction and impossibility, Nehemiah saw hope. And so not just to continue their work, but to protect themselves and to build up this dream and to make that dream a reality. So not only do they continue on, not only do they persevere, they actually take practical steps to making sure that they are protected, not just from these taunts, but maybe from physical harm. So they are building, but they also have one another, and they also have Persian soldiers that Nehemiah brings in. So it's not just, oh, you know, buck up and we'll finish this. They actually take practical steps. But even more important than those steps, they continue to believe in themselves, and they believe in a God who is present with them. Rather than run away, they finish what they have started. And they might continue to hear those words of doubt and negativity, but instead of retaliating, Nehemiah and his people, they pray. They pray as they continue. And as Nehemiah writes, so we pray to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. So not only do they pray, they take practical steps. They help each other. They stay by each other. They believe in each other, and they believe in God's presence, that God never leaves them. Sometimes faith and choice are the only things that we have left when every other voice is telling us we can't do it. So what will we build on our wall? What are we in the process of building or perhaps creating? Thursday night at our annual conference communion service at Florida Southern, Bishop Sue Hopper Johnson preached. Now, I know many of you know Bishop Sue. She was once an associate pastor here at this church. We know everyone loves Bishop Sue. In fact, she got a standing ovation even before she started preaching. She said things that I will not repeat because I wouldn't give it justice. I would just muck it up. But there is this one thing that I want to share that she said. She said, if I had one wish, it would be that every single person would know that they are cherished. What if instead of trying to get people into our church by saying things like, you know, we have a great program, we have great classes, we have a great building, what if instead we said, you know, if you come here, when you come here, you will be cherished. You will be loved for who you are. And when you fail, like we all do, we will pick you up because that's what others have done for us here. We have all failed. We have all felt like failures, but we pick each other up because we believe that is what God does for us. And so Bishop Sue said, that is the church that the world needs to see. That is the church the world needs to see. And I also want to say that night during communion, I saw it. I saw the dream. And you know when I saw it? It was when our 1120 band was singing. So I don't think it's any surprise maybe to folks who don't know, but you know our 1120 band, they were our worship leaders throughout annual conference. And that's what they did. It wasn't the singing. They were leading worship. They were embodying worship. And again, I don't want to put into words what they did because it wouldn't work. But, I mean, they were able to take the entire experience and they funneled it into their songs. And it was then that I saw it. I saw it when they were singing Brokenness Aside, I Am a Sinner. If it is not one thing, it is another. And in the midst of this, something started to happen. And it was happening through the whole time of communion, but there was a moment there. It was a kairos moment. If you don't know what that means, ask me later. But there was this holy moment that seemed to stretch beyond time and space when the dream became a reality. And it was in these words: I will not boast in anything. No gifts, no power, no wisdom. I will boast in Jesus Christ, his death and resurrection. As followers of Christ, as United Methodists, the phrase going on to perfection, it is not about us being without mistakes. It's not about us getting it right 100%. It is not about our failures. It is about our dreams aligning with the dreams of God. That's what it means to be perfect. When we find ourselves to that point, we are 100% aligned and dependent upon God's presence, upon God's dreams, that they become our own. The dream that no one experiences words or walls of rejection or discrimination, but instead experiences being cherished, experiences rebuilding and restoration and resurrection, and that they experience it here at an open table, a table that is open to each and every one of us. In spite of our past, in spite of our decisions, in spite of our failures, we are cherished. This isn't just about lifting up our own dreams. This is about us being able to come together and lifting up the dreams of each and every one of us. That is when the kingdom of God comes to life. So, how do we bring down walls of doubt and rejection and build up walls of encouragement? What are those opportunities in our lives that we are able to connect and create to allow our dreams to become reality, to encourage each other and to build each other up? Nehemiah may be focusing on gathering people together to rebuild this wall and to rebuild this city, but of course, it is more than that. It is about rebuilding people, rebuilding their dreams, rebuilding their faith. I think Jesus was much more about restoring people to connect with God and with one another. Each of us has the ability and the gifts and the worth to do that for one another. And maybe we just need a reminder from time to time about who we really are, people who are created by God and thus people whom God loves. Those are words that we need to say. Those are words that we need to show. Those are words that we need to live. That is a dream worth building. And so it starts here. It starts here when the tools for building are not bricks, are not swords, are not shovels or axes or crowbars or forklifts. They are bread and cup. For this is what Jesus is building within us. Where we hear those words of failure and we hear those words of rejection, those words that cause dust to fall upon us that we feel like we instantly have to brush away. Jesus says, that's not who you are. You're not a failure. You belong to God. How could that ever be a failure? And so take the tools that I give you. And these tools, they're not just tools for work. They are tools for life. I know not everybody in here is a Lord of the Rings fan, but there is this awesome, awesome scene when Frodo, who is this 3-4-foot-tall hobbit, has been charged with this impossible task, goes before this beautiful, immaculate elf and says, I don't know how I can do this. I'm not strong enough. I'm not a warrior. I can't do it. And she leans down, bends down, so she's eye to eye with him, and she says, even the smallest person can change the course of the future. It's not about being strong enough. It's not about being big enough. It is about believing in ourselves, and not just believing in ourselves, but knowing that God believes in us and that God has gifted us and created us in such a way that it is not a failure. We are not failures. We are loved by God. And in our brokenness, we can also experience healing and we can receive healing. When we come together and remind each other, yes, failure sucks, but let's try again. And not just because it's the cool thing to do, but because it is something worth doing. Cherishing one another is too important for us to feel like we can't do it. We can do it. You can do it. God believes in you. That's what people need to know we are about. So let us go out into the world as the church who cherishes one another so that all may know the brokenness that Jesus Christ not only experiences, but also recovers from. And it is possible for us too. That's what we need to tell the world. Go and cherish one another and go in peace. Amen.